Talk given Sunday, 23rd May, 1976. We have several statements scattered through the scriptures regarding the qualifications, the characteristics of the great spiritual teachers. Let me quote you what the Buddha said on the night of the Enlightenment. The Brahman, whose nature is unsinful, not harsh, unstained, self-restrained, who has mastered knowledge and fully trod the path of the holy life, he rightly, a Brahman, ought to speak the scriptural word, the Brahma word, the word of truth, or whatever you like to use for Brahma in this context. He is one who has no self-obtrusiveness on the world. And again, there is a statement with regard to the Buddha himself, what sort of a person he was. This question gets asked, and the answer which is given by one of his greatest disciples is this: the Lord is perfected, wholly self-awakened, endowed with right knowledge and conduct, welfarer, knower of the worlds, incomparable charioteer of men to be tamed, teacher of devas and men, the awakened one. He makes known this world, creation with its recluses and Brahmins, those who have attained excellence and men, having realized them all by his own super knowledge. He teaches Dhamma, the truth, the doctrine, that is lovely at the beginning, lovely in the middle, lovely at the ending, with the spirit and the letter. He proclaims the treading of the path of the holy life, entirely fulfilled, quite purified. It were good to see perfected ones like these. And then in the Upanishads, there are various statements, and also in what are known as the law books. You have all heard of the laws of Manu, for instance. Now, the laws of Manu deal very scantily with law in our modern sense of the term, the laws of the land. But they deal considerably with matters spiritual. And we have a very interesting statement regarding the nature of the teacher and the relationship between teacher and pupil, master and disciple. The guru is to the chela as a father to his son, and it is his duty to instruct him lovingly. Loving him like his own son and full of attention, he should teach him the sacred science without hiding anything in the whole law. Law is sometimes used as a translation of the word dharma. And he shall not use the pupil for his own purposes to the detriment of his studies, except in times of distress. Use him for his own purposes in this context means sending him on errands or anything like that. He shall spend all his time teaching the pupil, except in times of distress of the guru himself. If he's very ill and he needs to call for help, then it is right to send the pupil on that errand, to call in the doctor, etc. A teacher who neglects the instruction of his pupil no longer remains a teacher. Then, in the Institutes of Manu, the Laws of Manu, as they are sometimes called, it is stated that a man destitute of sacred knowledge is indeed a child, and he who teaches him the Veda is his father. For the sages have always said, child to an ignorant man, and father to a teacher of the Veda. You will find this in the Buddhist texts too, in the Book of the Discipline, for instance, the Vinaya Pitaka, when the Buddha has to reprove some errant monk, he uses the word bala. And it has been translated in this context constantly by the word foolish, foolish man. Of course, it is a legitimate translation because the monk is an adult, a grown-up, who has erred from the path, and so the Buddha calls him a foolish man. But remember that the word used is bala, which means a childish fellow. He hasn't really grown up. It's rather interesting. Childish fellow. Of him who gives natural birth and him who gives the knowledge of the Veda, the giver of the Veda is the more venerable father. For the birth, for the sake of the Veda, bears eternal good. Let a man consider that he receives only bodily existence when his parents begat him through mutual affection and when he was born from the womb of his mother. But that birth which a teacher acquainted with the whole Veda in accordance with the law procures for him through the sacred verse is real, exempt from age and death. He goes on to say, created beings must be instructed in what concerns their welfare without giving them pain. And sweet and gentle speech must be used by a teacher who desires to abide by the sacred law. He, forsooth, whose speech and thoughts are pure and ever perfectly guarded, gains the whole benefit which is conferred by the Veda. Let him not, that is the teacher, let him not, even though in pain, speak words cutting to the quick. Let him not injure others in thought or deed. Let him not utter speeches which make others afraid of him, since that will prevent him from realizing the real benefit. And then, in the Upanishads, talking of the teacher, and throughout these Yoga Upanishads, I'm reading from the Yoga Upanishads, the teacher, of course, is always a yogi. A true yogi is one who is the real spiritual teacher. And this indicates some of the qualities which characterize the yogi. He in whom there is established control of the senses, control of the mind, purity of mind and body, truth, contentment, straightforwardness, poverty, and non-ostentatiousness. A very important point to bear in mind when you consider the contrast with the conventional orthodox established churches with all their magnificent robes and this, that and the other and so forth. Non-ostentatiousness. When one does not, through actions, mind or speech, commit any sinful act in relation to any being, then he becomes fit for eating alms food. This point about alms food is just this, that all the spiritual teachers lived as almsmen, mendicants. They begged for their food. They didn't ask for it, they just stood silently with a begging bowl. And whatever was put in was gratefully accepted, and the teacher, the yogi, blessed the giver. If the person gave nothing, and sometimes as we have in the Buddhist accounts, even reviled and abused the teacher. The Buddha himself was abused time and again. He remained silent and blessed the other person. Having become quiescent through the control of the mind, one should take up sannyasa, that is, the life where one has given up the world. That held good in the old days. Nowadays things are different, as necessarily they must be and have to be, because the world has changed a great deal. And so today's there is a different order of things. Courage, fortitude, the control of the body, honesty, purity of mind and body, control of the sense organs, conscience, knowledge, truth, and the absence of anger, these are the characteristics of one who represents and teaches the Dharma, the spiritual teaching. One who does not look back with pleasure upon past enjoyments, nor forward into the future, is fit to become a spiritual teacher. And it goes on in that strain. But I think I've read enough to indicate reasonably fully what were the implications. Now the question arises, or rather one of the questions which arise is this: how do we find such a teacher? Well, there is a counter question to that. If I am going to find a teacher, I must be able to recognize the man who is fit to be a teacher. But if I am fit to recognize such a man, I myself already have developed all those qualities. There is one very interesting discourse, the Buddhist discourse, in which the Brahmin Janussoni by name, who was chaplain to the local Raja, the local king, asked his pupil whether the enlightened one, the Buddha, had lucidity of mind. And the pupil answered, "Who am I, sir, to say whether the Lord has lucidity of mind? Only one like him could know whether the Buddha had lucidity of mind." Now, I have put all this forward because, as you know, in our modern world, there are so many who are seeking, earnestly, sincerely seeking. How are they to find the genuine teacher? It's a very difficult problem. We go to so-and-so or so-and-so because we hear from somebody, oh, so-and-so teaches this, that, and the other. Teaches meditation, teaches yoga, teaches the Eightfold Path, etc., and so on, you see. By hearsay. Now, hearsay must have existed in the old days also, because there are passages in the Buddhist texts which speaking about the Buddha, say a very favorable report has been spread by householders and all others regarding this particular teacher. There were, of course, several teachers existing in the days of the Buddha, rival claimants to the spiritual throne, so to say. And there were reports about them. And there were reports about the Buddha. I read you the statement of the disciple Kacchana, the great Mahakacchana, as he was called, regarding what the Buddha was like. Now that was the kind of report spread about him. So we have reports to go upon. So and so does this, so and so has lectures or classes or retreats or schools of wisdom or schools of meditation and so on and so on. Now, how does a teacher really teach? Is it by the words he speaks, the ideas, the doctrines that he hands over? Or is it more by virtue of some indescribable, indefinable influence which emanates from him, which first and foremost makes you feel at home with him? You feel an affinity. You say, yes, this is fine. It appeals to me. If one brings into play one's conditioned standards of judgment, then one will be approaching and searching in the wrong way. Because then all that one is looking for is something which will, someone who will merely corroborate the views that oneself already holds. What is the use of that? If you merely want the corroboration of your own views, you don't want to go to any teacher or anybody. You believe in those, all right, you carry on. Live by them. But if one goes with an open mind, and this is the important point, with a completely open mind, and listens in the true sense, then there is an inner understanding. And if there is an inner understanding, it will be very considerably free of ordinary intellectual approval or disapproval. You know how easy it is. We go and hear somebody speak. Oh, and we agree with this, that, and the other, but we do not agree with the certain other things which he said. He's quite wrong there. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Simply because they are not my views. That's why I say that. Now that way, one doesn't really learn. You can't learn that way. One can learn only by considering together with an open mind. What is the meaning of the word consider? This is very important. Con, meaning together with, and sidus, sideris, the Latin for a star. A star is a self-shining light. It shines from within itself, enlightened from within. So to consider means to look deeply into the light. To look deeply into the light. One must have eyes which are capable of taking in that light, standing that light. And the taking in of the light does not mean being gullible, nor does it mean being critical in the limited, antagonistic intellectual sense, because one's own mind is argumentative. But to look deeply into the light, when something is said, or ideas are presented, means that one is capable of understanding the inner significance, the living substance and context of what is said. Understanding is a live process. It is not an acquisitive process. It implies a living relationship between mind and mind. A living interchange takes place. And that interchange expresses itself in the forms of thought or concepts and speech. So, considering together means exchanging words in such a manner that this living interchange takes place. The mind, as a living organism, lights up in that case. And then there is understanding. Not just a superficial acquisition or grasping of certain concepts, certain mental constructs, which in themselves are fixations after all, and they hinder real understanding and therefore real spiritual growth. Now, if one then can meet with somebody who is of such a nature within himself that the influence that goes out of him is something which appeals to you, a live relationship is formed between oneself and that other person. And in this living relationship, I, as the seeker, will truly learn something. And to learn means to grow happily. The mind, as it grows happily, is learning. And by this process of learning, intelligence in its reality comes to flower step by step. Intelligence in its reality is the capacity we have within us to see the truth of things as we come across them through all our sense apprehensions. Hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, feeling, and so on. This intelligence is released from within. The power of intelligence to function freely is released from within by this living interchange. So that I am learning all the time. And in my act of learning, I am conferring teacherhood upon the person who is called the teacher. It is very important to understand this living nature of the relationship between a person who is called the teacher and a person who is called the pupil. No teacher can impose his teaching upon another. When anybody says, "Oh, I'll teach you this, that, and the other," he is speaking rightly only within the context of a specific technique, a know-how. I can teach algebra or chemistry or English literature or something. English literature perhaps not quite so much, because there's much more the subjective creative element involved in it. But everything that is of a routine mechanical nature can be taught in the conventional sense of the word teaching. And he can quite legitimately and honestly set up as a mathematics teacher or a teacher of engineering or whatever it is. But where this master-disciple relationship is concerned, in the spiritual sense, the growth and coming to fruition of the living human being is concerned, that relationship, the conventional mechanical relationship in the world of affairs that we know of, doesn't hold good at all. Here, the learner, the person who is seeking, must be prepared to learn, wanting to learn. And if he succeeds in learning, which means he succeeds in the release of this power of intelligence within himself, then the other person who has appealed to him and has influenced him in the right way is the teacher. So it's the disciple, in a sense, who is the more important, the learner. Because if I, as the learner, I may have a very sincere desire to learn, but I may be so stupid and lacking in the capacity to learn that he can't teach me anything. There is that wonderful story. In all probability, it is a true story, an actual fact. A seeker after spiritual truth, who already was at a considerably advanced stage, went to a teacher and said, "Teach me. Demonstrate the supreme truth to me." And the teacher was completely silent. And after a while, The pupil repeated the request. And for a third time he repeated the request. And the teacher said, I am teaching you the supreme truth all the time. But you have not succeeded in understanding that I am teaching you the truth by silence. This pupil wanted to learn the supreme truth. In the spiritual sense, in the fully developed yogic sense, and the truth was identical with the condition of silence. Now, this is extremely important for us to understand. The truth in the religious sense is a transcendent reality, is the transcendent reality. It is incommunicable by any techniques which are known to superficial mind. I'm not saying to a superficial mind, but to the surface mind. The surface mind is the image maker. It is the imaginative faculty. It makes shapes and forms in terms of concepts, beliefs, convictions, ideas, and so on. But in making these shapes and forms, it is trying to constrict the illimitable, the transcendent, the infinite, the absolute, into something particular, limited, finite, and relative. The absolute completely subsumes the relative. You understand the meaning of the word subsume? It is completely involved in the absolute. The relative is completely taken up into the absolute. The relative is contingent, dependent upon the absolute. But the absolute, whilst wholly subsuming, containing within itself the relative, is independent. It's non-dependent in relation to the relative. Now, as and when the learner, you yourself, I myself, is capable of realizing this state of silence completely throughout the whole psychophysical organism, this organism, this living person, who is a manifestation of the relative, is completely in tune with the absolute, the unconditioned. And in that sense, this creature is completely silent. It does not mean that he is not receiving impressions, that those impressions are absorbed in his being, and at the same time there is free passage outwards from him of these surface mind activities and energies. And that is just the ordinary everyday play of life, the things which happen from day to day, and so forth. But he's at the same time aware of and at home in this immensity which is immeasurable. Call it the depths, call it the heights if you like. But those are words which belong to the relative, depth and height. It's the totality. There is that state of being completely in tune with that totality. When one is in that state, the full power of intelligence functions, and one is learning all the time. The holy ones, the perfected ones, are the best pupils in the world. The great teachers are the true disciples, the true pupils. They are learning all the time. Learning, growing happily. Translate it that way, growing happily. It's something which comes as a shock to us. We think of the holy ones, the perfected ones, as, oh, they have finished the job. On the contrary, they have begun a transcendent job. They haven't finished the job. You see, this is the difficulty with words, and how words, which have lovely significance in the world of the limited, are the obstructors in the world of the unlimited. What do we mean by perfected? Take something which Mozart has written, simple though it may be, it's a perfect thing. Or the poetry of the great poets, or the sculpture, or the painting, and so on, the work of the great scientists, the mathematicians, they produce miracles of the surface activity of the mind. As and when the surface activity of their mind has roots shooting down, rays of life, light, shooting right into the heart of the transcendent, they don't know it, but their creations, as we call them, bear the stamp of the immortal. We talk of the immortal works of the great artists, the poets, and so on and so on. See, it happens with them that way. So our idea of perfect depends upon our ability, through the limited, finite external form, and any symphony or any poet or any statue is a limited, finite thing, belongs to the realm of mortality. Because it has this power to give us complete satisfaction, aesthetically, intellectually, and so forth, we say, this is perfect. You can apply that in the mechanical world. An instrument, which is made to perfection, we say, this is perfection. Now you see, and we call it a finished object. It's finished. In the sense of craftsmanship, the finish of the craftsmanship. Perfection, perfected, completed. And of course, for us, it is the end point. It is an end point. But there is no big ending where truth is concerned, or life in its inmost reality is concerned, where the spirit, what we call the spiritual world, is concerned, where transcendence is concerned. There is no ending, nor is there a beginning. You see, beginning, ending are limited concepts which hold the mind in subjection within our own being. And the mind in subjection within our own being is our particular psyche. When a person says, my mind, it would be more correct to say, my psyche. Mind is a word which I believe would be better used in terms of the universal. Mind is this universal something, just as space is this universal something. You can't carve out a little bit of space and say, oh, that space I brought from England, look at it, isn't it lovely, beautiful, green country, England. That space will be will certainly not be green. You see what I mean? Now, mind is like that. It's a universal something. You can't limit it, you can't handle it, you can't see it, taste it, touch it, anything. But mind as this indefinable, indescribable, I'll just use the word energy for the sake of using a word, this mysterious energy functioning through this particular material organism gives rise to psyche, which shows definite characteristics. Mind in itself is without any characteristics. No characteristics, just energy, pure energy. Characterless. When the Buddha uses a phrase like vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato bhavam, anidassanam means characterless. It has no characteristics, no qualities. Therefore, sometimes it is translated as invisible. You know, there's a lovely Christian hymn which is sung in the schools, which still observe morning prayers and so on. What is it? Something immortal, invisible, etc. Invisible is the word used, you see. Anidassanam, anantam, without end, and therefore without beginning, therefore free of all limitations of time, therefore in the realm of eternity. Rather a poor phrase, realm. The moment you say realm, you think of something circumscribed, but what's one to do? Words are like that. They are a very poor medium to convey the illimitable. So now, mind is like that, but psyche has its reality. My psyche, it's specific. A specific manifestation in terms of the surface activities of mind, which are constantly restrictive. As and when, through intense mindfulness, wide awakeness, this is the supreme task of the yogi. You know why it is said that the yogi never sleeps? This is what it means. It's not that he never sleeps physically, but he's always awake inwardly, whether the body is also awake or whether the body is asleep. This attention inside him, this power of paying attention is perpetually awake, functioning in more fewer dimensions of consciousness. That attention is continuously awake. And because that attention is continuously awake, he always knows that these surface activities and the surface mind presentations pretending to be the truth are only ephemeral, temporal manifestations, pictures of the living reality. And a picture as such, you take that portrait, it is not alive. Of course, the skill of the artist lies in painting such a portrait that you say, oh my goodness, it looks alive. That is the highest praise you can bestow upon it, isn't it, practically? So now, these surface pictures, which means the doctrines, the dogmas, the thoughts, the systems of philosophy and all the rest of it, they are to be understood, and you have to let them go. And the reality of mind, this something which is of eternity, of transcendence, begins to act more and more freely through yourself, the living organism. And this is the growing happily spiritually. And this is enclosed in the supreme silence, which is not the opposite of noise, remember. For us, silence means the absence of sound. It isn't that. There are no words, but silence is about the nearest word one can use. It's an extraordinary state of peace. It's a state of dynamic poise. It is neither action nor inaction as we know it in our ordinary worldly context. Now in this state there is a perpetual learning, a perpetual growing happily. Now, who is the teacher who can teach you this? No one. When I, the seeker, desiring to learn, meet with somebody who appeals to me and with whom a fruitful relationship can be established. When I meet such a person and there is a continual living interchange taking place, I, the seeker, become stimulated in such a manner that from within myself this living process goes on. Within myself this living process goes on, and the power of intelligence comes to fruition, and I begin to see things from the light within. If I try to see things as the teacher is presenting them to me, I am not a true disciple. I am not really learning, nor is he a true teacher. Your true teacher is one who will help you to learn the art of discarding all that belongs to the realm of duality and multiplicity. Discarding it not by throwing it away, but by utilizing it to understand its ephemeral nature, that it belongs to the realm of the relative. This is not the transcendent. This is not God. This is not the Atma. This is not liberation. You see? When, in the days when I used to have pupils who came to learn the piano from me, I'm one of the very few people who has had the fortune to learn from Solomon for 8.5 years the art of piano playing and how to produce that marvelous tone that he produces, that utterly beautiful sound from pianissimo to fortissimo and so on and so on. I used to tell them always that I shall count my success as a teacher by the swiftness with which you can be free from coming to me for lessons. And they'd be utterly surprised. But this is the fact. Now, it's the same in the spiritual world. If a person sets up as a teacher and keeps you, he's holding you in bondage. But if you and the teacher meet continuously year after year for the next 135 years because of love, because of understanding, because of the growth of a living human relationship, a true sangha, a true synagogue, that's a different story altogether. But if it is a case of holding the others in order to keep on imparting ideas and concepts and doctrines and dogmas and binding that other person's mind, then that teacher is a rogue. He's a jailer. He's an exploiter. You remember I read that phrase, fit for alms food. If a teacher is a true teacher, he is free of any exploitiveness. He is a beggar. Not a person who has to be supported by his pupils, by his disciples. The disciples, the pupils are utterly free. The teacher is utterly free. There's a relationship of complete freedom and therefore of happiness and friendship, real friendship, man and man. This is an example of the true meaning of society, of being social. The interchange between man and man, whoever the two men are, king and commoner, dustman and duke, anybody. When that sort of relationship is there, this is a true society, based upon complete freedom, complete understanding, complete love, complete considerateness, a complete validation of the one by the other, like that. So you see how a human society differs from a herd of animals. Look how the word social and socialism is used and expressed and has been used and expressed throughout the years. The true homo socialis is the liberated Holy One. And he is the true teacher. And he in himself is the true learner also.